Court is now in session, please be seated.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Danielle Gibbs from Young Conway, Stargate & Taylor. On behalf of nominal defendant Yahoo, Inc., I'd like to introduce the other counsel at counsel table. Also on behalf of Yahoo, Incorporated, Jordan F. from Morrison & Forster.
Good afternoon.
On behalf of the individual defendants Yang, Philo, and Valenzuela, we have Ms. Lynn Schuler from the Williams & Connolly firm. She has been admitted pro hospice. And Arthur Connolly III. On behalf of the other individual defendants, Mr. Alan Stone, Mr. F. will be presenting the argument for all appellees and nominal defendant Yahoo. If counsel for the other individual defendants have anything to add in rebuttal time, the arguments will be presented by Mr. Stone or Ms. Schuler.
Thank you, Ms. Gibbs. Always a pleasure to see a former clerk in the court.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Robert Goldberg for plaintiff below appellant Judith Jacobs. With me at counsel table is John Harness, who will be presenting the argument on behalf of plaintiffs, and he's been admitted pro hoc vice.
Afternoon, welcome.
Also seated is Joan Harness, his associate, both from the firm of Harness and Keller in New York.
Welcome.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. This case is about a concept called spinning. And the term spinning is a euphemism for bribery. And that is what this case is about, bribery. The payment of consideration to corporate fiduciaries for the misuse of their position of trust and of funds entrusted to their care by shareholders. Plaintiff's allegations are not based upon conjecture, but upon the reported findings of a congressional committee investigating the phenomenon of underwriters using allocations of hot IPOs to garner business. Although the claims asserted in this action are, in the first instance, framed in terms of corporate opportunity, as Chancellor Chandler held in the eBay case, the breach of duty here is more fundamental and goes to the core of the fiduciary principle. This is not a case involving issues of interpretation, such as did the directors pay too much, did they review all alternatives. Here the wrongdoing could not have been more blatant had Goldman Sachs delivered envelopes filled with cash to the insider defendants in exchange for business. The consideration paid to Yahoo's corporate insiders, namely, profitable transactions that were virtually guaranteed, was the functional equivalent of cash. And as we noted in our brief, it was what Professor Coffey has termed free money. So from plaintiff's perspective, there is only one issue in this case. Is demand excused? And I'd like to address that issue in two parts. First, addressing what is the applicable standard that this court should utilize, and secondly, the application of that standard. Plaintiff asserts that demand is excused because the majority of the directors of Yahoo are disabled from objectively considering a demand to bring litigation. The disabling considerations identified in the complaint are ones that have been long recognized by this court. In one instance, financial interest. In one instance, lack of independence. And in three instances, involvement in and approval of transactions that were not the product of business judgment. The only wrinkle in this case is that not one of the above three considerations affects a majority of the directors, but that each affects a number of directors which, when taken together, constitute a majority of the Yahoo board. Because while defendants have attempted to characterize Plaintiff's theory of futility as novel, it really isn't. Only the fact pattern is novel, but there is no reason why the well-established factors that have been applied in many decisions by this court should not be applied here. And addressing specifically the issue of the Aronson test, which was a subject of briefing by the parties, In Aronson, this court recognized that a director cannot consider demand to sue himself where the plaintiff has adequately pled a prima facie case against that director. This recognizes the common sense proposition that a director cannot consider impartially well-pled allegations that accuse him of wrongdoing. There's nothing in Delaware law to suggest that directors who have acted in bad faith when approving transactions are disabled from considering a demand when they constitute a majority of a nine-man board, but are not disabled, these same directors are not disabled when they are only four members of a nine-man board. And just to illustrate my point, I'd like to give an example, a hypothetical example. Assuming that five of the nine directors were directors who approved these improper bestowing of business upon Goldman Sachs, and that would satisfy the Aronson test. If one of those directors resigned and defendant Filer replaced him, one of the actual wrongdoers who received the unlawful payments, there is no logical reason why demand should be excused in that case, merely because the five directors who approved the transaction were reduced to four. Now, I'd like to address specifically whether the complaint adequately pleads allegations as to whether the three directors, whom I will term the holdover directors, are disabled because of their participation in the wrongful conduct. And as I said before, it is well settled since Aronson that where plaintiff pleads facts that demonstrate a challenge transaction was not the product of business judgment, those directors whose conduct was implicated by the breach of duty are disabled from judging their own conduct. In this instance, there are three directors, and the decision that they made was twofold. First, they approved the retention of Goldman Sachs, and that is clearly an exercise of business judgment, or lack of business judgment, for that matter. It's an exercise of judgment. And the second issue was whether they knew of these hot IPOs being given to Yang, Filer, and Valenzuela, whom I refer to as the insider defenders, and made a determination not to. With respect to the first question, the approval of the retention of Goldman Sachs, I think I made at the outset of my argument a pretty clear case that this approval of Goldman Sachs was not the product of business judgment. The approval of Goldman Sachs as underwriter for Yahoo was the product of a corrupt process. And the corrupt process cannot be the product of business judgment. These allegations, in plaintiff's view, clearly call into question whether these directors breached their duty of loyalty, or termed another way, whether they breached their duty of good faith. And this is not an, this is, in addressing quickly the issue of 102b7, this is not an unambiguous claim of breach of the duty of due care. A court reading those allegations can infer that these directors violated their duty of loyalty. Now, looking at the allegations of the complaint, there are a number. Let me step back again, I'm sorry. Before I address that point, I think that I would like to address first the issue of 102b7 is an affirmative defense that has to be demonstrated by the defendants, or it's in the defense that I have to meet at the pleading stage. It's plaintiff's view, as I said previously, that the claims involving the giving of business, the retention of Goldman Sachs, clearly there is a set of facts from those allegations that could give rise to a breach of the duty of loyalty. It is not an unambiguous claim of the breach of duty of due care, as the language of this court has used. However, even assuming that the plaintiff is required to allege facts to meet this affirmative defense, I think the complaint does. There are a number of facts that are alleged in the complaint that demonstrate that the directors had knowledge of the allocation of IPOs to the insider defense. The first factor is the sheer quantity of these transactions. The complaint alleges that there were 250 allocations that were made over a course of a number of years to the insider defendants. And this 250 was a figure that was taken from the reported findings of the Congressional Committee. As a consequence, the insider defendants do not appear to have been surreptitious about these IPO allocations. To the contrary, they appear to have been brazen about them.
Counsel, I hesitate to interrupt, but I'm going to assume all these arguments were made to the Court of Chancery. Can you go directly to how the Court of Chancery got it wrong when it decided the case the way it did?
Your Honor, there were two principal arguments that were made to the Court of Chancery. One is whether the myriad of business transactions between the insider defendants, all of the directors, created an inference that the board was dominated or controlled by the insider defendants. As the second alternative argument, we made the arguments to the Chancery Court that I am making here today. On appeal, I have not abandoned my first argument, but recognize that it's weaker than the one I am making today. And so I am pressing that argument exclusively. The argument as to whether the Aronson test, for lack of a better way to describe it, should be applied to the conduct of these three directors was never addressed by the Chancery Court, because the Chancery Court held out of the 9-member board, there were 3 directors who were involved or holdover directors from the challenge transaction. There was 1 director, Yang, who was clearly interested in the transaction, leaving 4 out of the 9 directors, but that the 5th director, whom plaintiff alleges is not independent but is beholden to the insider defendants, the court found that he was in fact independent, so finding that even if we proved or established, I should say, that the 3 directors were disabled and that Yang was disabled, that would still only leave us with 4 directors. And so the court never addressed the issue of whether these directors were disabled from considering demand, because he found the 5th director, Semmel, to be independent, and therefore he did not have to reach that issue.
Well, why was he wrong?
Well, I will then get to the issue of whether Semmel is independent.
That would be a good idea.
Okay, fine, Your Honor. Delaware courts have long recognized that past associations can form the basis for finding a lack of independence. And a beneficial financial history or past relationship has been found to raise a reasonable doubt as to director's independence. Or even a single payment to a third party has been found to create a sense of owingness. This includes donations to universities, which do not result in cash being given to the director, but the consideration being a benefit to his reputation, which is substantially less than the amounts at issue here, which are $250 million. The Vice Chancellor also, I should say, in reaching the issue of whether Defendant Semmel was independent, did not address the question of owingness, which is one of the basis of the appeals today, and which was argued to him in the court below. The amount involved in this at the time of the Chancery Court opinion was estimated to be $100 million. And since then, it's been reported in the news that these options have been cashed out to the sum of $230 million. Plaintiffs submit that the sum of $230 million is a very substantial sum, that the $230 million, a reasonable person can infer that amount can create a lot of influence. And the reason, the facts that are alleged that from which a court can infer that Semmel would have a feeling of obligation or owingness or gratitude to defendant Yang are facts that were alleged in the complaint. First is that Yang established his relationship with defendant Semmel before the position of CEO was open, and before anyone was being considered to be CEO of Yahoo. Secondly, it was Yang who selected defendant Semel. He was the one who recommended, identified Semel as the best candidate to be CEO of Yahoo, and he was the one that presented him to the board. Third, Yang was the one who negotiated his contract. In short, it is Semel's relationship...
Well, wasn't there a compensation committee involved?
There was a compensation committee involved, Your Honor. But I think this goes... There are two inferences that can be drawn from that. One is the compensation committee certainly is the committee that ultimately approved the compensation that was paid to defendant Semel. But as alleged in the complaint, the contract was negotiated by defendant Yang. And there are two possible, there's certainly the possible inference that with respect to board conduct that the vice chancellor took, where he said because defendant Semel reported to the board, therefore he wouldn't be subject to inferences by defendant Yang. My response is, of course, that every CEO ultimately reports to the board and is still subject to influence by individuals. In this case, the allegations are that it was Yang who selected him, Yang who negotiated